You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's show, deadly fighting has broken out in Lebanon's capital after soldiers shot and killed two anti-Assad clerics. Our Beirut correspondent will be with us live. Is the Corsican separatist movement back in action? A series of explosions last week may offer clues. We'll be heading to Corsica to find out. And as Mitt Romney names the woman who will vet his vice presidential options, we'll be asking our Washington correspondent what makes a good Veep. All that, plus our very own tribute to Robin Gibb, all coming up on Midori House here on Monocle 24. But before all of that, here's Nick Kelly with the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. President Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi has vowed that Yemeni security forces will step up their efforts to clamp down on militants after a suicide bombing at a military parade rehearsal in Sana'a killed 90 people. The bombing also wounded about 200 people, making it the bloodiest single incident in the city in recent years. Yemen's defense minister and chief of staff were both present at the rehearsal for Tuesday's National Day parade, but neither was hurt. Monocle contributor Tom Finn, based in Yemen, witnessed the attack this morning.
I visited the site of the attack, and it was clear that it was a huge explosion. I saw blood, items of clothing strewn across the floor, kind of 30 or 40 meters away from where the explosion took place.
NATO leaders have sealed a landmark agreement to hand control of Afghanistan over to its own security forces by the middle of next year, putting the Western alliance on an irreversible path out of an unpopular decade-long war. The NATO summit in Chicago formally endorsed a US-backed strategy that calls for a gradual exit of foreign combat troops by the end of 2014, but left major questions unanswered about how to prevent a slide into chaos and a Taliban resurgence after the allies are gone. A spokesman for the Afghan Interior Ministry spoke about the challenges of gaining full control of security.
Well, the main challenges are the equipments and, of course, training. We need to focus and invest a lot on the training of the Afghan security forces and also the commitment which is there by the international community for the equipment of the Afghan forces.
NATO has also been trying to persuade Pakistan to reopen its territory to NATO supplies, which Islamabad has blocked since NATO forces killed 24 Pakistani soldiers in a cross-border incident last year, but a deal was not expected to be clinched by the end of the summit. Mali's caretaker president Dion Kunda Traore was beaten up and hospitalised after hundreds of protesters stormed his palace today to demand his resignation. A spokesman for the soldiers behind a March the 22nd coup said Traore's close protection officers had killed three people in the attack, in which protesters entered parts of the palace compound unopposed and tore up pictures of Traore. Mali is struggling to cope with the aftermath of the coup and a subsequent rebellion in its desert north. Former US President Jimmy Carter met the Speaker of the Egyptian Parliament, Mohamed El Khatatni, today on his visit to Egypt to monitor the first presidential elections since the revolution, which will take place on Wednesday. The Carter Center is one of the groups who will observe the elections. However, they'll be unable to say whether the process is free and fair because their movements are being restricted by election authorities. US Congressman David Dreher told reporters after the meeting the US sought strong bilateral relations in the future.
There may have been placards for presidential candidates in the past, but everyone knew who was going to win. So this is the first time in 7,000 years, first time in human history, that there is real uncertainty as to who is going to be the president of Egypt.
The Libyan convicted of the 1988 bombing of a Pan Am flight over Lockerbie was buried today in a quiet family ceremony, ignored by most Libyans keen to forget the international controversy that surrounded Abdelbaset al-Megrahi in life. Megrahi, who always said he was not responsible for bringing down the jumbo jet on the Scottish town and killing 270 people, died in his bed in Tripoli on Sunday, surrounded by family. Russian President Vladimir Putin unveiled a government dominated by loyalists today, tightening his grip on the economy and national security after protests and limiting Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev's ability to pursue market reforms. Putin opted for continuity by retaining his ally Igor Shuvalov as first Deputy Prime Minister in charge of economic policy, while Igor Sechin will remain his energy chief in a role outside the government. And tributes have been paid to the late singer Robin Gibb of the Bee Gees, who died yesterday after a battle with colon and liver cancer. The Who's Roger Daltrey said Gibb was one of the world's best singers.
To me, singing is about moving people. And Robin's voice had something about it that could really move me, and I'm sure millions of others.
And those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick. It's 18:05 here in London. We're going to be talking about violence in Beirut right after this. You're listening to Midori House. It's the most recent example of the Syrian insurgency spilling over its borders. Today in Beirut, soldiers killed two opposition clerics at a military checkpoint in northern Lebanon. 18 others were wounded in the clashes between rival political groups early this morning. The shootings are a reminder of the intense violence that afflicted the country from the mid-70s up until 2005, when Syrian troops pulled out of Lebanon. For more on this and what the near future holds for Lebanon, I'm joined now in the studio by our Beirut correspondent, who I'm glad to say is in London at the moment, not Beirut, Carol Corm. Hello, Carol.
Hi, Steve.
First of all, could you sort of bring us up to date as to what's been going on in Lebanon today?
Well, I think I'll go back a little bit to last week, just to give a bit of a context. There's been fighting in Tripoli between anti-Assad Islamists and Alawis, who are pro-Assad, pro-Syrian regime. One of the Islamists was arrested. This created even more tension. People were unhappy. This Sunday, there was a protest, two protests that were supposed to be take place. Two clerics, two very prominent clerics that were against Syria, were shot down by militaries at a checkpoint on Sunday. That was yesterday, which is very unusual. And okay, this has caused yesterday night problems in Beirut. There was a lot of shooting, and today the situation's very, very calm. No one went to school. No traffic, and people are kind of staying at home and watching the news.
Now, I mean, as we said, Syria was involved in Lebanon for an awfully long time until troops left in 2005. But I mean, Syria's still had an incredible influence over Lebanon even since then, hasn't it?
Definitely, definitely. I mean, they're not officially in Lebanon, but they have very strong ties with a lot of political parties. There's a lot of people who still support the regime, and the events that have been taking place since last week are not completely removed from the situation in Syria. A lot of people are accusing, pointing fingers, even the elements of the army that shot these two clerics on Sunday. Some people say they were basically commanded by Syria, who's trying to create a little bit of havoc, I think, in Lebanon. Last Friday, the Syrian ambassador to the UN accused Lebanon of creating the whole situation in Syria. He didn't mince his words. This is in the face of a government who's trying to appease, who's trying not to intervene, who's trying not to criticize Assad. So now they're a bit in a difficult position.
Bearing in mind that sort of very, very close relationship, are you surprised that that things haven't sort of spilled over sort of earlier? I mean, bearing in mind that this, the uprising began in Syria, more than a year ago now.
Yeah, I think in a way we were lucky, but I mean, it's depressing because you really feel. I mean, this assassination yesterday of these two clerics was clearly provoked to create havoc, to have people go against the army, to have Sunnis and different factions of the Lebanese community go against each other. Some people recall the early civil war in 75, when there was some assassinations that also created tensions between different sectarian groups. So the elements here are not very good, not positive.
And you've been talking to lots of people, you know, in Beirut today. I mean, what's the mood that you sense from talking to people there? How tense is it? How worried are people?
People are quite worried. I was surprised how much they were worried. People didn't send their kids to school this morning. People have been watching the news a lot. The streets have been very calm. People are worried, you know, I mean, this is the summer season. This is the biggest season for Lebanon. Weddings, a lot of things are happening. So now everything's a bit put under question mark. Also, I think it's Bahrain, the UAE, and Qatar have advised their citizens not to come to Lebanon. The U.S. Embassy in Beirut has sent a warning to its citizens to watch out. We don't want to hear this. We don't want to see this.
I mean, is there a sense that this is, you felt you'd almost sort of move past this now, that this was what used to happen, but now, you know, this wasn't what you expect in Beirut?
Yeah, and the images of yesterday of these you know, hooded guys in Beirut, in the streets of Beirut and in Tripoli, you know, where are these weapons coming from? Just shooting randomly at cars passing by. It's a little disquieting, you know. Suddenly all these people pop out from streets that everyone takes every day. And then we're all confined to our houses, watching the news again. It's a scenario the Lebanese have gone through 100 times and are really tired of.
Do you think the fact that it's a scenario, as you say, Lebanese have gone through 100 times before, it makes it more likely that enough people will come together to say, OK, let's not go down this road again? Or is that looking at things slightly too hopefully?
Well, I'm an optimist. I'm hoping. But I mean, the beginning of the civil war was the same. The majority of the Lebanese did not want a war. But there's so many manipulations and dirty tricks being done in Lebanon right now, as there was back in 75. So it doesn't take much. All we need is a small group of troublemakers. And Syria clearly wants to create problems in its neighbor country. The regime is in a difficult position, and yet it's still managing to destabilize Lebanon. Let's see.
How do these sorts of incidents affect everyday life? I mean, you've already mentioned that, you know, children weren't going to school today, and lots of people are staying inside. You know, if things continue like this, in what way does it affect businesses, whether that's, you know, in the tourism or
it's
in other sectors?
It's a confidence. You know, I was reading people were already cancelling trips to Beirut for the summer. Yeah. I know people are getting married next week. I mean, you know, they're having people coming from all over the world. So confidence is, you know, are we going to have a party? Maybe we're going to scale it down. Maybe we'll postpone it, that kind of stuff.
And as you say, it's obviously tourism season the height of the tourism season is about to hit. How crucial is tourism to the Lebanese economy?
It's huge. And I mean, basically the whole year, people are just waiting for the summer to come, because that's when everything happens in terms of, you know, I mean, you have maybe a bit more than 1 million of people coming, expats, tourists. So we've had a lot of summers ruined recently, 2005, 2006. We're hoping this one is not going to be ruined once again.
And now, you know, we were talking before about, you know, what's been going on in Beirut today, and you said there's been some peace protests. I mean,
just a bunch of young people who spontaneously decided, watching the events yesterday, that they were going to have a peace walk on Martyr Square. So it's going on right now. There was also one in Tripoli on Sunday. I think it was on Sunday, with lots of kids, you know, wearing white T-shirts and talking about peace. And this it goes back, you know. It just needs a few troublemakers to gun down some important figures, and there you have it.
I mean, so when you see those sorts of peace protests, I mean, do you think, okay, this is the sort of thing that could help us sort of get through it, or are you worried that it might just sort of make things worse and that it sort of leads to some sort of confrontation?
Listen, the average Lebanese doesn't want war, and is a calm person, but there is a fiery group of people who have an interest in creating havoc, and it's related to what's happening in neighboring countries.
You say you're an optimist. But you're sounding quite pessimistic at the moment. I mean, have you felt this pessimistic about the situation in Lebanon for a while at all?
No, it's been a while. It's been a while. But you always hope for the best. Even if today I sound a little bit pessimistic, you just hope things will calm down and by next week they'll have resolved it. But I think until the situation in Syria is resolved, it's going to be shaky in Lebanon.
And if we look at the situation in Syria, I mean, that doesn't look like it's going to be resolved anyway soon, certainly not in a way that's going to make people very happy.
No, I think the international community needs to step it up, but I think Russia has no intention of stepping anything up. I think they think this is going to be like Chechnya, that they can just let the Syrian regime kill its people and people will forget and time will pass. I mean, the Syrian regime has been around since Kissinger. They know what they're doing. They've lasted all U.S. presidents, and now they're playing with fire in Beirut, in Lebanon. I don't know. It's a waiting game.
Okay. Well, Carol Corm, our Beirut correspondent, who I'm pleased to say is currently in London. Thank you very much for coming into Midori House. We're going to be right back with our own special tribute to Robin Gibb right after this.
In Tasmania, talented craftspeople are making use of the island's natural materials to design and build furniture and ceramics. Monocle video journalist Gabriel Lee toured the island to meet the designer makers, putting Tasmania's personality on the map.
It seemed to me that if I was going to make pots at this time and in this culture, I needed to say something about being here and now. And the way to do that was through the materials.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films from affairs to business, culture to design in the programs menu on monocle.com.
The June issue of Monocle is a round-the-world ticket that takes in the best boats and planes and trains in our annual transport survey. We also reach for the skies as we climb to the top of Tokyo's new Skytree Tower, stay ahead as we meet an Ethiopian Olympic icon, and visit Kolkata as the city tries to step up a gear. And there's lots more.
In the culture section, Aisha Spears looks beyond the Steers and Stetsons to profile the gallerists and collectors at this year's Dallas Art Fair. Design Miami founder Craig Robbins talks us through his art, and there's a wonderful column on the art of wandering.
In the design section, we head north to Stockholm for a global exclusive of Ett Hem, a small hotel with big ambitions to shake up the hospitality industry.
There's also our 36-page Thailand National Survey that puts a spotlight on the country's top tech firms, horticultural hothouses, and some cool brewers too. The June issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're back with Midori House, and we'll be delving into the June issue of Monocle magazine a little bit later. Now, as you heard, Robin Gibb, one third of the Bee Gees and a singer-songwriter who helped to turn disco into a global phenomenon by providing the core of the soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever, has died from cancer. This song we're going to play for you is from the album right after they did Saturday Night Fever. It is the title track from Spirits Having Flown. That was the Bee Gees there with Spirits Having Flown. It is 1823 in London. You're listening to Midori House. The idyllic Mediterranean island of Corsica may be in the beginning stages of a return to nationalist violence. Last week, a series of explosions ripped through various targets around the French-administered island, targeting holiday homes and cars owned by foreigners. Corsica is no stranger to such attacks. For three decades, a low-level separatist movement has stirred up passions on the island, which has been described as fiercely independent. Yet attacks similar to last weekend's have not occurred for decades. No group has yet come forward to claim responsibility for the recent bombings. However, the initials of the FLNC, or the Corsican National Liberation Front, were found written on a building close to one of the explosions. To give us a deeper analysis of what's been going on, we're joined now from Corsica by Antoine Albertini of France 3. Antoine Albertini, thank you very much for joining us. Has this new wave of violence taken Corsicans by surprise?
You said that was these kind of facts are pretty known in Corsica, but that's also pretty new because since 2008 there wasn't so much bombings in the island because of the arrest of left terrorists. So people living here are not so surprised, but they can't understand why this time the National Liberation Front, one of the very last terrorist organizations, maybe the last of Western Europe, they can't even understand, and neither the cops.
Is there much popular support amongst ordinary Corsicans for independence?
Not at all. Polls here give the feelings pro-independence about 8%. That means with a population of 300,000 people, I let you do the count, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 people in favor of independence. So they don't have real support by population here.
And let's look at these bombing attempts. I mean, there were some reports say 17, some people say 19 or even more.
19.
And lots of different explosive devices all over the island, most of which didn't actually explode. But I mean, does the scale of these attempts worry some people that this has obviously been sort of very well organized?
No, they seem to be, but they're not. That's very easy, on the little roads, little country roads, to take a car, to put some gas tanks in a house occupied by people living outside, mainly French people or Italians. That's very easy to put a bomb near a house, which is empty at this period of the year, and just let it start and go away. This series of bombings really don't mean that these people are organized.
And how worried are people? I mean, you say that they don't need to be that organized, but this has gained an awful lot of attention. We're coming up to a big tourist season. Are people in Corsica worried that maybe tourists will stay away?
Oh no, unfortunately people are pretty accustomed to this kind of fact here, even since like I said, since 2008, even since there wasn't such attacks. But you have to understand that these bombings are some kind of messages sent from a group to another group, because you have to know that there is not a single National Liberation Front of Corsica. There are a lot of avatars, I'd say, and these were not really operational targets. These bombings are kind of messages just to show muscles from a group to another.
And bearing that in mind, is there any concern that there may be more?
A lot of people here are reflecting on the meaning of these bombings, and the gendarmes, that's our typical military forces of police, are now investigating on a very, very numerous murders committed into the past 5 or 6 years. And these bombings are a part of business war between former terrorists who are now doing some business in the real estate or tourism or every part of the business where you can make a lot of money, and mob groups. And you have also in Corsica now some intrusions, I don't know if the word is correct, of a Russian mafia specialist here, especially in the southern part of Corsica. So you got a very explosive situation, and the French Ministry of Interior don't know how to deal with that.
Okay, Antoine Albertini of France 3 in Corsica, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a mo.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Then a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24, your episode.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24. The Blue
Pajalabad. Monocle 24.
This is 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 Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll speak to Anastasia Maloney in Bogota about why Colombia is on the rise. We'll learn about the Republican vice presidential search process, and we'll hear why Ukraine's first Pride parade was called off. But first, here's Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
Thanks, Steve. A suicide bomber infiltrated a military parade rehearsal in Yemen's capital Sana'a today, killing 90 people and wounding 200 in the bloodiest single attack in the city in recent years of instability. NATO leaders have sealed a landmark agreement to hand control of Afghanistan over to its own security forces by the middle of next year, putting the Western alliance on an irreversible path out of an unpopular decade-long war. Mali's caretaker president, Dion Koundé Traoré, was beaten up and hospitalised after hundreds of protesters stormed his palace today to demand his resignation. Hundreds of Islamist gunmen have fired in the air as they laid to rest a Sunni Muslim cleric whose killing ignited street battles that brought the bloodshed of Syria's uprising across the border into Lebanon. The UN nuclear watchdog, the IAEA, held extensive talks in Iran today ahead of a six-power meeting with Tehran later in the week. The former US President Jimmy Carter has met the Speaker of the Egyptian Parliament, Mohamed El-Khatatni, on a visit to Egypt to monitor the presidential elections taking place on Wednesday. The Libyan, convicted of the 1988 bombing of a Pan Am flight over Lockerbie, was buried today in a quiet family ceremony, ignored by most Libyans keen to forget the international controversy that surrounded Abdelbaset el-Megrahi in life. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has unveiled a government dominated by loyalists, tightening his grip on the economy and national security after protests, and limiting Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev's ability to pursue market reforms. And tributes have been paid to the late singer Robin Gibb of the Bee Gees, who died yesterday after a battle with colon and liver cancer. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
The June issue of Monocle has just hit newsstands, so all this week on Midori House, we'll be delving inside to bring you a little bit more on some of the bigger stories across the magazine. Today, we start with the A section and our lead story, which focuses on Colombia's increasingly strong foreign policy role within Latin America. We sent our Bogota correspondent Anastasia Maloney to Cartagena for the Summit of the Americas, and she also spent a couple of days inside the country's foreign ministry. Anastasia joins us now live from Bogota. Anastasia, welcome to Midori House. Tell us a little bit about what the Summit of the Americas was like, because I mean this is a huge event. It's 30 plus heads of state from both North and South America, and an awful lot of security, I imagine.
Yes, for Colombia, this is probably the most important international event they've ever hosted, certainly in recent history. And they certainly cut no corners when it came to security. There were 20,000 extra police that had been shipped in from across the country to stand on the coastal roads and inside hotel lobbies, on street corners. The CIA had apparently been thinking about security for up to a year before the event. All the American delegations, which is about 2,000 people from the U.S., attended the summit. Trade specialists, business specialists, they all stayed in certain hotels. They were all overtaken with CIA agents and security that the Americans had brought in. There were helicopters above. There were submarines. There were deep sea divers as well. So the security is really tight.
And I imagine the entourage for some of the smaller countries was perhaps nowhere near that of America's.
No, some of the smaller countries like Jamaica, Suriname, they stayed in nice hotels, but obviously much less profile and very little security they had. Basically, the big security was for President Obama and Hillary Clinton.
And tell us about the summit itself, because obviously a lot of the coverage in the international press focused more on what a handful of US security service agents got up to at night in Cartagena. And obviously in the piece that you wrote for us, we dwelt more on, you know, how this was sort of what this all meant for Colombia, the event. But talk us through the actual summit itself. What were the big issues discussed?
Before the big summit, when Obama and the other presidents, the 30 other heads of state came, there were actually 2 days before that of other important summits. And probably many people are saying that that was the most important part because it meant that lead business leaders from across America got together. And that's one of the first times that huge, very important business leaders from Coca-Cola, big multinationals, were in one place at one time in Colombia. And apparently a lot of deals and networking went along there. I think the other big topics as far as the leaders were concerned was trying to integrate Latin America more, trying to connect countries with terms of internet, electricity, energy issues. And also the other issues that overshadowed the summit were Argentina and its claim on the Falkland Islands and the question of whether Cuba should now be welcomed at future summits. Those two issues overtook the agenda on the leaders when they met.
Now, when we, you know, when you wrote your piece, we obviously sort of focused quite a lot on how Colombia has become sort of an increasingly sort of powerful foreign policy voice within Latin America, partly because now their domestic issues are sort of more settled than they certainly were 10 years ago. You spent time at the Ministry of External Relations. You met the foreign minister, Maria Holguin. What's she like? What do you sort of what sort of feeling do you get from her?
She's surprisingly low-key and softly spoken. She speaks in measured tones. She's careful about what she speaks. I mean, she's obviously a diplomat, and she is very careful about the message she's sending. The main idea is that Colombia is open for business. Colombia wants new trading partners. Colombia wants to keep its traditional diplomatic relations strong with Europe and the United States. But it's also looking eastwards towards Asia and China, and it's making no apologies about it. And it wants to also become a greater leader within Latin America and also be known as sort of the broker in the region. And she was quite clear about that. I think the most impressive thing about the Foreign Minister Holguin is that she's very clear about where Colombia wants to be. They have a plan, they have a vision. It's not improvised, it's not made up as they go along. And that's basically the first time I think Colombia's seen such an ambitious foreign policy that wants to make its name not just be known as the main ally of the US in the region, which it has previously, but really branch out and make sure that its growing economy has new markets. And those are the things that came through in my interview with her.
I think one of the most interesting aspects of the piece was how they are, you know, expanding the number of diplomats they have, the training program for new diplomats, but also about how they're trying to find diplomats from different places out, you know, across Colombia. They're not just focusing on the elites in Bogota that they're used to.
That's right. One of the interesting facts that came through from my interview with the head trainer of the diplomats at the Diplomatic Academy School was that they have a shortfall of around 200, 300 diplomats. So they're really on a constant recruitment drive to try and make sure they got enough diplomats just for the basic running of embassies. And the lady in charge, she was saying that before, particularly people in the provinces, people who didn't live in Bogota, people perhaps who lived in rural or not so big towns, they had no idea that even a diplomatic career existed. And they thought they had to know someone, be well connected, have the right accent, have the right education. And so they're now bringing the embassy and the diplomatic service into the provinces, she was saying, where they set up sort of trade fairs and come and meet the ambassadors, those kind of days, and make sure it's much more friendly, much more approachable. And she's making it easier for potential candidates to sit exams now they don't have to come to Bogota. So the whole process has become much more friendly and open. And she's saying, you know, it's not a question of who you know now. It's now based much more on merit.
When you look at Colombia's role within Latin America itself, I mean, obviously, you know, Brazil is the big power, has had this sort of a huge amount of attention on its foreign policy over the past few years, particularly under its previous president, Lula da Silva. Do you get the sense that other countries within the region are happy to look to Colombia in a way that they used to look to Brazil?
I think it's more that Dilma Rousseff is definitely not seeking the limelight as much as her predecessor Lula did. And she's not circling the globe as Lula did. And I think that there's a feeling, there's a vacuum, there's a space for leaders to fill. And President Santos of Colombia, he definitely sees himself as filling that gap. So there's, it's also an advantage in terms of timing for him. But also that while there's not that strong leadership from Brazil as there was under Lula, I think people are more than happy for Santos to fill that gap. And also there's a sense that Colombia is credible now because it has had so much experience in fighting drug cartels, in fighting the guerrilla insurgency, that they now are selling themselves as people with experience, with a proven track record that can help other countries. And Central America is definitely looking to Colombia for help, as is the United States informing its anti-narcotics policy in the region.
Anastasia Maloney in Bogota, thank you very much for joining us. The story is our lead story in the June issue of Monocle, which is on newsstands now. Go get it. You're listening to Midori House. Mitt Romney, the Republican candidate for president of the US, has named a longtime aide, Beth Myers, as the woman to lead his search for a running mate. In recent elections, the choice of VP candidate has become a real acid test, no more so than last time around when John McCain picked a certain Sarah Palin. So what will Romney's choice tell us about him, and who is he likely to pick? To answer those questions and more, we're joined now by Sasha Eisenberg, Monocle's Washington correspondent. Sasha, welcome to Midori House. Let's start with that first question. What will Romney's choice tell us about him?
Well, it'll tell us something about him and something about the state of the race. So I think one reason that McCain did something that his advisors since acknowledged was pretty desperate in picking somebody he barely knew was because he felt he needed to do something dramatic to win. So probably the safer Romney's choice looks in mid to late August when he makes it, the more we'll know about how confident they are that they can beat Obama on the current terms of the race and don't need anything that will, in the words of the famous book and movie, be a game change. But then there's also right telling in that we learn about Romney. McCain liked to play poker and craps in Vegas and describes himself as a gambler, and the Palin thing was A.B. Culverhouse, who was the lawyer who was running the search, described as high risk, high reward, and McCain took the bet. Romney seems a very cautious person, and so if he does something, goes to somebody he doesn't have a personal relationship with or who's not a sort of proven national political figure, it might tell us that he's either a little riskier than we had imagined or a little more desperate than we had thought.
And does the choice actually make any difference? I mean, when we look back on previous elections, you know, was the fact that, you know, Dick Cheney was an experienced sort of hand on the tiller, did that make people vote for George W. Bush over Al Gore in 2000?
Generally, the best research we have suggested it's had very little impact on the ticket. Certainly, you know, there's been historically an idea that candidates can help in their home states. John F. Kennedy picking Lyndon Johnson, two guys who really did not like one another, was thought to give Kennedy a boost in Texas, for example. There have not been a lot of examples of this recently. And the general, there's an idea that Dan Quayle was a real harm, not a real harm, but some harm to George H.W. Bush. And Bush, when he ran the second time in 1992, was encouraged by many of his advisors to dump Quayle from the ticket. And Bush, out of some loyalty, stood with him, even though he thought he could do better. But generally, there's some downside with bad VP picks. Palin may have been among them. There's probably not a whole lot of upside. So you hear a lot of political people repeat the sort of Hippocratic oath that doctors know, which is first do no harm. And we've probably seen more harmful picks recently than helpful ones.
So if Romney's looking for someone that will, first of all, do no harm, what are his options?
Rob Portman from who's a senator from Ohio who served in the Bush administration as the budget chief and trade representative is thought to be a very competent, serious guy who's respected and probably would be unlikely to be stumped in an interview or make a glaring mistake in a debate. It would be something close to the Cheney model. It would sort of show that Romney had picked somebody who might not be a sort of sexy campaigner, but would probably be a very able partner in governing. That's the sort of leading, sort of safe, boring white guy establishment pick.
Which would also look a little bit like Mitt Romney himself.
Yeah, and there's a case to be made for this. Clinton picked Al Gore in 1992, which was thought at the time to be surprising because the old logic of sort of matching for a ticket was the idea that you balance the ticket somehow. You get the regional balance of Kennedy and Johnson, or if 8 years earlier Mondale had picked the first woman, Geraldine Ferraro, to run with him, there's some idea that you can find a sort of or if you come from two different wings of the party, you can sort of expand your range. Clinton picked a guy who looked very much like himself, a Southern moderate, young, which is the most important thing, sort of new generation baby boomer politician, and the feeling among the Clinton people is it was very successful because it emphasized the parts of Clinton's campaign that were most appealing and the most valuable contrast with Bush. And so if Romney decided that he wanted to go into the fall as a safe, unexciting, competent technocrat who has real credibility on economic issues and wanted to sort of shine a big spotlight on that part of his pitch and disregard the others, picking Portman in particular would be a way of sort of highlighting that, in part because it would feel redundant almost to a point of reinforcement.
And if, for example, he's feeling a little bit desperate and he feels he needs to take that risk, is that when we look at someone like Marco Rubio, the young Florida senator?
Right. Rubio is the sort of the dream candidate of most Republicans, and in many ways there doesn't seem to be a huge downside for him strategically. He's really popular with conservatives. He got elected with a lot of Tea Party support in Florida, but he also has a record as a serious person and is sort of respected and is Cuban-American and would be the first Latino on a ticket of either party and thought to have reached there. The risk with Rubio is that he might not be ready. He's been a senator for an even shorter period of time than Obama was when Obama ran for president. And while he's been pretty involved for a junior senator in foreign policy issues just in the last year, you could certainly have reason to believe that he might not be up for a debate with Joe Biden if it got into the particulars of the Pakistan situation or ready to talk about monetary policy in a sophisticated way in an interview. And I think that the guy just has fewer hours under his belt playing politics at the highest level. And the day-to-day successes of a vice presidential candidate rarely get noticed or celebrated, but any mistake obviously will get plenty of attention. And so I think there's a sense with Rubio, for all his appeal, that he just might not have enough laps around the track yet.
And I guess one name we can probably rule out is Beth Myers. She's unlikely, isn't she, to do a Dick Cheney and be in charge of the vetting process and then say that she's the best choice.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, that was a big shock for everybody. Myers is incredibly trusted by Romney. She's been around forever, and it's a sign that I think that they want to have a secretive process, but a fairly rigorous and deliberative process. McCain put a man he didn't really know in charge of his process, and to some degree, the way it spun out of control in the end might reflect that. I think with Romney, my guess is there are very few secrets between Romney and Myers, and so it won't be something where Romney feels like his decision is being made for him by somebody who's not close.
Sasha Eisenberg in Washington. As ever, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House. We're right back after this.
From São Paulo to Sapporo, from Brooklyn to Buenos Aires, with a samba, bossa, jazz, poppier, rock and roller, frankly far superior station, to discover the newest and finest sounds. This is the sound of Monocle spinning its musical globe. Check in with our editors turned DJs as they whisk you through the time zones as we take you continental, Atlantic and Pacific. Round the clock, round the block, music on Monocle 24.
To keep up to date on the latest issue of Monocle, new films on our website, products in our shops, and new programmes on Monocle 24, sign up for our free weekly bulletin. We'll tell you about special Monocle events and make sure you're ahead of the curve with all the happenings at Midori House. Just go to monocle.com to subscribe. Let's stay in touch.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's 18:49 here in London, and it's time for another song. This is Shells of Silver by the Japanese pop stars.
When the cold of the day is over and the warmth of the night moves in, there's a howling that stays beneath my skin.
That was Shells of Silver by the Japanese pop stars. It's 18:53 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. Now, this Sunday, what was supposed to be the first ever gay pride parade in Kiev, Ukraine, didn't go exactly as planned. Half an hour before the start, the police were advised the organisers to leave because a group of right-wing football hooligans were on their way to disrupt the event. Two of those activists were beaten up. Max Tucker, Amnesty International's Ukraine campaigner, was at the parade and he's on the line now to tell us a bit more about the situation. Max, thank you for joining us on Midori House. What was it that you saw happening?
Well, I was actually at the Pride March. About a few hours beforehand at 12 o'clock, we saw a large number of skinheads, youths from associated with football clubs gathering on Central Square in Kiev. They didn't know exactly where the protest was going to take place, but they were clearly waiting for something to happen. We then went to the protest venue, at which stage police said that those skinheads had amassed greater numbers and were on their way to the venue to disrupt the march, at which point the organizers of the Pride decided that the only safe thing to do, considering that the police were not prepared to deal with this, was to cancel the event.
Well, I want to sort of pick you up on that. You say, you know, that the police appeared not prepared to do anything about it. I mean, what were the police saying that they could do at all? Were they just saying, sorry, not our problem?
Well, the police said, look, it's your decision, but if you go ahead, people are going to be injured. We won't be able to protect everyone. We'll have to make some arrests. There will be some fights. And it was very clear from the way that the police were laid out, this is not how you police correctly a pride march. There was no cordon sanitaire. There was no ring of protective line of officers to separate protesters from counter-protesters. So it was very clear that it all seemed very ad hoc, and it didn't seem like it was a good venue. And it seemed like it would be quite dangerous to go ahead with the pride.
Now this,
they basically didn't give any assurance to the organisers that they would be able to protect them.
I mean, this sort of incident sadly isn't uncommon within Eastern Europe. We've seen similar things, in fact, with even worse violence at times in both Warsaw and Moscow when they've attempted pride parades there. Is there anywhere within Eastern Europe where you feel that some progress has been made and that, you know, these sorts of events can go go along sort of trouble free?
Well, I think there are different situations in different countries within Eastern Europe. In Ukraine, we see that it's a particularly unhealthy environment for LGBT activists. I mean, they are violently attacked. We saw during the Pride, shortly after the evacuation, that two activists were very severely beaten up by football hooligans. And it's kind of, at the same time, there's the authorities are not doing anything to protect LGBT activists. We've got legislation coming into force or coming to Parliament at the moment, which could outlaw distributing any information which gives information about homosexuality.
I mean, we're coming up to the European Football Championships. I mean, they start next month in Ukraine. The eyes of the world, or certainly Europe and football fans all over the world, will be on Ukraine. Do you get any sense that the authorities there are willing to make any concessions on human rights, not just for for things like gay pride, but for other human rights issues as well?
Well, it's very surprising. You would have thought that there would be a real commitment from the Ukrainian authorities to demonstrate that they're putting human rights first when there's this kind of international spotlight on them. But in fact, we see that they have made very little effort to reform the police, a corrupt police system which is going to be targeting fans because they're affluent and the Ukrainian police are used to extorting money from people. That's a widespread problem in Ukraine is police criminality. And there's been very little real commitment to doing anything other than maybe a little bit of improving infrastructure and building huge stadiums. The human rights has definitely not been a priority for the Ukrainian government.
Okay, Max Tucker, Amnesty International's Ukraine campaigner. Thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. And that, I'm afraid, is pretty much all we have time for today on Midori House. Thank you very much for joining me. The producer of the show was Daniel Giacopelli. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. Coming up later on Monocle 24, as ever, we've got Monocle Daily at 2200 hours London time. Ted Kravitz and Chloe Potter are your hosts tonight. The news is next, followed by a very special episode of this week's Culture Show with Robert Bound. He's just back from Havana. He had lots of mojitos, he brought back some cigars, he brought back some music, and he brought back a very lovely report, which you'll be able to hear right after the news. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.